Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Okay, we're going to talk with William Cohan from Vanity Fair in just a second. But first, every Friday, Kimberly Johnson and I record a fourth podcast each week. But this one is different from the usual Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday shows. The Friday After Party podcast is loaded with all the politics you want, while also including uncensored, completely obscene conversations about sex, drugs, movies, television, and our personal lives. All the stuff we can't get away with on the free show. And it's generating all kinds of comments and conversation on our Patreon page at BobSeskaShow.com. Don't miss out on all the action. Please help support this show by subscribing to our Friday After Party podcast for just $10 per month. That's BobSeskaShow.com, or just click the all caps Patreon link beneath the logo at BobSeska.com. And now let the cartoons begin.
Broadcasting from Resistance Headquarters, relentlessly fighting back against the clown dictator and his regime of deplorables.
Never give up, never surrender.
This is the Bob Seska Show, presented by BubbleGenius.com.
From our nation's capital, it is Wednesday, October 30, 2019, and this is the interview edition of the Bob Seska Show on the Sexy Liberal Podcast Network. My guest today is author and journalist William D. Cohan, contributor to Vanity Fair, The Atlantic, The New York Times, and the author of The Last Tycoons, House of Cards, and The Price of Silence about the Duke Lacrosse scandal. Bill also wrote the bombshell item in Vanity Fair titled, "There is definite hanky-panky going on, the fantastically profitable mystery of the Trump chaos trades." Link in the description. So the question of the hour, is Donald Trump manipulating the stock market and profiting off his own manipulations? All right, let's find out the answer to this question and much more with Bill Cohan. By way of setting up how I got into this story initially, I've been following this story for the better part of 2 years now, just on my own, observing what's going on. I first noticed this trend in 2018, whenever there was a gigantic one-day sell-off. It was almost always connected to one of Trump's blurts about the trade war. Then I went back and noticed how the various indexes were climbing steadily all throughout 2017. But then as soon as Donald Trump declared the trade war on or around January 22nd, 2018, the volatility began and these enormous one-day losses that we were experiencing. Turns out, 8 of the top 10 largest one-day point losses off the Dow occurred in 2018 and 2019. In fact, the top 5 biggest one-day losses of all time were from the last 2 years. And this is what sparked my suspicions about these potential chaos trades. What convinced you that it was worth looking into all this? How did your part in all of this get started?
Well, I don't know that, quote unquote, I have a part in all of this other than, as you probably know, I had worked as a banker on Wall Street for close to 20 years, an M&A banker, and been writing about Wall Street and other things for the last 15 years mm-hmm. as a full-time writer. And so you just develop sources and people call you and talk to you and share with you their thoughts and ideas. And so earlier this summer, I'd started hearing from people who trade these e-minis, a new product that Chicago Mercantile Exchange developed that are tied to the S&P futures.
Yeah.
They just started sharing with me this thought that something didn't look right, sort of what you were seeing. They were seeing, you know, the Trump's ability to move the markets was, of course, well known by then. And, of course, he loves to talk about how it's the greatest market ever and he's responsible for it. And they just started noticing these trades that seemed to be tied to his pronouncements. And they were people, you know, which is fine. People can make bets and trades all the time, and they do, but they seem to be quite prescient, and the outcomes always seem to be positive, whether they were on the long side or the short side. So I first wrote about this in, you know, early July in Vanity Fair, and I think everybody must have been at the beach because there wasn't much of a response. And so then I thought, all right, well, he kept going on throughout August and then early September, you know, and to the point where when Trump was in Biarritz for the G7, he basically spoke about conversations he theoretically had with Chinese officials about the status of the trade negotiations, which turned out to be some more of his fiction, which the White House had to agree to. And so then I wrote this piece as sort of a follow-up to the first piece. And for some reason, everybody was at the beach the first time, and this time everybody was back from the beach, apparently, and it became you know, a cause celeb. So I, from my perspective, I was just being reportorial.
Yeah.
And, you know, I can't explain why the first one, you know, flatlined and the second one didn't.
Mm-hmm. In fact, one of the chaos trades you describe in your piece is based on a Trump lie. You were mentioning the G7. I mean,
right.
George Conway, Kellyanne's husband, said point blank that this was a market manipulation by the president. I mean, does Trump or his goons have to be taking advantage of these manipulations for them to be illegal or even, dare I say, impeachable?
Well, look, I'm not a securities lawyer. I didn't even play one on TV. I was an M&A banker. But, you know, I know for a long time, obviously, Congress was exempt from insider trading laws. I think that's been rectified in the last few years. Yeah. Remember, there are no explicit laws regarding insider trading. It's more case law that judges create by their rulings, and the insider trading laws seem to apply, if I have this right, only to the equity markets, which frankly I've never really understood, because the bond market is 4 to 5 times the size of the equity market. There's every bit and more opportunity for sort of manipulation and the using of inside information to make money in the bond market as there is in the stock market. And the same thing applies in the futures market with trading these E-minis. So this is something that I felt, and that's why I wrote this, that this is something that the regulator should look at. You would think that that would be something that they would want to do and take seriously doing. Instead, you know, I've gotten this, you know, colossal pushback on how dare I point this out, that this might be going on. Not that I, you know, was certain it was going on, just that I believe the people I spoke to believe this was going on, and there was evidence that the trades took place. And this is what regulators should be doing, or what regulators in the era, non-Trump era, should be doing. But now, you know, you just don't know whether Jay Clayton, who's the head of the SEC, even though he had a fine reputation before he became SEC chairman, whether he takes this kind of thing seriously, or it's just, you know, was told by Trump just to lay off, or any of the other regulators whose job it is to look at these things. Yeah. Are going to just like ignore what's going on here.
Yeah, I think there were two equal and opposite reactions to your piece. On one hand, you had the Slate article, and I want to get to that in just a second. But then on the other hand, you had this letter that was, I think, signed by 17 different Democratic senators and sent down to DOJ, SEC, and the other regulatory bodies. I mean, what was your... Yeah. What was your reaction when that came down, when that news came down, that you had actually gone from a piece in July where everyone was at the beach and no one read it? And then suddenly you published this piece. And as you said, it kind of exploded, including this particular letter.
I mean, my thought was this is exactly what the regulators of the securities business should be doing. So I was glad that the senators found it worthy enough to recommend that the regulators do their job. Now, what are they doing? I have no idea. Whether they, will they find any? I mean, part of me hopes and prays they find nothing, because that would be worse. I mean, it would be much worse for all of us if they were found to be trades that were connected to either Donald Trump's quote-unquote goons, as you described them, and in his statements. Obviously, he's quite happy to make these statements that he knows will move the markets and then talk about moving the markets, and it would not surprise me one bit if the people around him or him himself were taking advantage of doing that.
And in fact, my default position is to perpetually hope that I'm wrong about Donald Trump. I mean, literally about everything. It would be so much better if I was wrong in everything I'm observing and interpreting in terms of what comes down from the White House. But, you know, if I were Trump...
But you rarely are wrong, and none of us are rarely wrong.
I know. It's a double-edged sword. But, you know, if I were Trump and I routinely engaged in unethical, I mean, in plain sight, unethical and illegal activity, I, of course, and I try to do this, I try to put myself into Donald Trump's worm-ridden head and try to figure out how he's seeing all of this based on what I know about him. You know, I'd be inclined to take advantage of the fact that I could so easily move the markets with my tweets. I mean, my hunch is either he's personally profiting through straw investors or he's tipping off friends. I mean, are you willing to take that extra step in terms of interpreting how he might be actually engaging in these trades, or who, what the connection to the actual trades happens to be? I mean, are you kind of looking into that?
Well, I will say this, that the people I speak to, who I spoke to about all of this, they certainly take that extra step and believe that, either Trump is speaking, you know, saying to, I mean, this is total speculation on their part, but, you know, hey, President Xi, look at the way I'm able to move these markets. You know, you're the only other guy, or you and your people are the only others who know really what's going on. And by the way, you can't possibly, I beg you to articulate for me what Donald Trump is trying to accomplish with these trade negotiations. I have no idea. Nobody knows.
Yeah, that's a big mystery.
And nobody
can
articulate it. I have no idea what success means in these trade negotiations. All I know is that he likes to say they're on, they're off, they're on, they're off, and the markets move as a result.
Yes.
These people, I think, absolutely believe that he is getting President Xi in on the act. He might be getting Erdogan in on the act. He might be certainly the Mnuchins and the Wilbur Rosses and the Larry Kudlows and, you know, his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, they're all sort of part of this, they believe. I don't know what to believe. Certainly wouldn't surprise me. I mean, this is a guy who says he can go down Fifth Avenue and shoot somebody and get away with it. So,
right.
You know, all this talk about how he's lost all this money being president of the United States, and it's hurt him. I mean, you know, cry for me, Argentina. I wouldn't be, nothing that the guy does, as you said, can surprise us anymore.
Yep.
I mean, and, you know, we just have to sort of make it through either the next year or the next 5 years.
And, you know, one of the things I try to do, Bill, is I try to be my own red team. I try to constantly disprove the things that are rattling through my head about Donald Trump. And along those lines, do you think it's fair for analysts or even myself, any of us, to link those massive one-day sell-offs to Trump's blurts about tariffs or China or the trade war or all of the above? I mean, is that a fair conclusion to draw?
Well, look, I think, first of all, when the markets go up, Donald Trump is more than happy to take credit for them going up because of something he better did. When the markets go down, you're right, they seem to be related or happening around the same time that he said something about the trade talks, you know, either being off or some other market moving event. You know, I also gave the example of the supposedly the Iranian attack on the Saudi oil fields. Look, the truth is nobody really knows why markets move up or down. It's you know, billions of people all over the world making judgments literally every second of every day about all sorts of inputs and factors. What is clear to me in my time on Wall Street and then studying and writing about Wall Street is that things start happening where the lines of fear and greed cross, and that's where, you know, the markets can take these unbelievable swings. Yeah. When, you know, it's a confidence game, and you saw what happened 11 years ago when people totally lost confidence. You know, I don't think we're there yet, but, you know, nobody rings a bell at the top of the market. I've written lots of pieces in the New York Times op-ed about how I think, how fragile I believe this financial infrastructure that we have. And again, the Fed just lowered interest rates just now, again, for the third time this year. I think that's a huge mistake, and I think it's going to precipitate a big market correction and a financial crisis of some sort. But, you know, and Trump plays a role in this, absolutely. Yeah. Don't forget, he said he was going to eliminate the national debt. Instead, it's $23 trillion and counting. The budget deficits are $1 trillion and counting.
Yeah.
Interest rates, he's jawboning them down to levels where they should not be.
Manufacturing's in recession right now, yeah.
Right. I mean, so, you know, I think Trump is playing this all for, I think he's personally playing some of these tradings in his statements that he knows will move the market for his personal gain.
Yeah.
I have no way of proving that, but that's where the regulators, I think, can help out. He's certainly jawboning Jerome Powell at the Fed to try to keep the economy pumped up and revved up as best as he can, despite the third quarter GDP number coming in below expectations.
Oh, yeah.
He's trying to pump up the economy, you know, for the next year so that he can be reelected. Because he knows one thing, and which is right, that it is about the economy, stupid. And if the economy is basically doing well, then, you know, his chances of reelection, despite being arguably the worst president in our lifetimes or in the history of the country, he can probably get reelected. I think the irony is, I think, that by jawboning the Fed into lowering interest rates for the third time this year when it is absolutely unnecessary to do so, I think he's hastening the next financial crisis.
Yeah.
And I think it's going to happen before before a year from now. And if that's the case, then he will have ironically blown up his own chances of getting reelected because of his choosing to do this.
And, you know, given the precarious nature of everything, it seems like it's immensely damaging to have basically the steward of the economy generating these massive short positions. I mean, that's the first thing that I was thinking of when I first started to see the volatility, that someone is making a mint off of short selling. If they know what Trump is going to say, if they have prior information about a Trump blurt, and they take out a short position, one of these giant short, in fact, you described one connected to the Saudi oil fields story.
Right.
It seems to me as if that's perpetuating the damage, that's driving things further down, because I'll let you describe the potential damage from a massive series of short sales linked to either the S&P or the Dow or NASDAQ, any of the markets. How does that drag down not only the value of the stocks involved, but the actual overall value of the markets?
Well, look, I think it's important to say to your listeners, and I'm sure they understand this, that you know, short selling and taking contrary bets, short bets, i.e. betting the market or a stock will fall, is an essential part of how the market works. For every buyer, there's a seller. For every seller, there's a buyer. That is an essential part of the way the market works. But if you are on the other side of these trades, right, if you took the long side of the short on the E-minis, you know, the day of the Iranians, if they did do this, blew up the Saudi oil fields, and you knew that oil prices would spike and that would drive down the market. If you were on the other side of that trade and somebody had this information that you didn't have, I'd be apoplectic, yeah. frankly. I mean, you know, it cost me millions of dollars, or my institution, or somebody, whoever is on the other side of these trades. And so if Donald Trump is sharing his this information about how things are going with the Chinese trade negotiations, or what might be going on in the Middle East, or any of the things that he knows by now move the markets. He's not an idiot. Yeah. He's been doing this for a long time. You know, and if you know that information and somebody on the other side of the trade doesn't, I would be apoplectic. That is not fair markets. That is yeah. not a fair sharing of information, and there's supposedly regulations in place to prevent that, certainly in the stock market, but there should be also regulations and enforcement in place in the bond market and in the futures market to make sure those things don't happen.
Okay, we'll return to our conversation with Bill Cohan here in just a second, but here's a question for you. Do you feel younger than you appear? Under eye bags, crow's feet, and wrinkles often add years to our appearance. And that sting, I hate it. When someone thinks you're 10 years older than you actually are, it's crushing to the ego, and the confidence level plummets, of course. Let's talk about a quick and easy fix called Plexiderm. It's a clinically studied serum that visibly eliminates wrinkles, crow's feet, lines, and under eye bags in just a matter of minutes. It's exactly what you need to win the battle against Father Time and restore your confidence. And if you don't believe it, that's okay, because I didn't believe it either. I had to do the test, and I was blown away by the results. Within minutes, I was looking like my younger self once again. The best part is Plexiderm goes on clear, so nobody's going to know that you're using it. You can put it under your makeup if you want to, and the effect lasts for hours. Go to TryPlexiderm.com, use my code SEXYLIBERAL for 50% off plus an additional $10 off. That's right, 50% off plus an extra $10 off. This offer is also available by calling 1-800-685-1292 and mentioning the code SEXYLIBERAL. Plexiderm is backed by a 30-day money-back guarantee. Visit TryPlexiderm.com today and use the code SEXYLIBERAL at checkout. That's TryPlexiderm.com, code SEXYLIBERAL.
The Bob Seska Show.
Describe one of these trades from your Vanity Fair piece that generated, in one case, like a profit of, $1.8 billion in a single purchase of E-minis. Describe that, to how that all came down, that particular trade, that big one, the gigantic one.
There were 420,000 yeah. E-minis that traded, before the market closed, the same June day that Trump was negotiating with President Xi, in Japan, I believe, about the trade negotiations. Yeah. And if you sort of work the hours between Chicago and Tokyo, you get clear indication, or a coincidental indication. I don't know. Certainly something fishy that it looks like, from people who I talk to, that somebody knew what Trump might be saying about those negotiations as they were happening, and made a big bet and profited from that. When he comes out of the meeting with Xi and says, hey guys, everything, guess what? The roller coaster of the trade negotiations is back on again, and the market goes up. I mean, you don't have to be a rocket scientist if you're a trader to see that Trump's commentary, whether he's sharing it in advance or not, is capable of moving the markets in a way that no other president has delighted in as much as Trump has. Yeah. He views this as a litmus test of his presidency, how the market does, and his ability to move markets delights him, which was what was so ironic about him getting caught out in Biarritz for the G7 in August, where he kind of made up his conversations with these Chinese leaders, and the markets react, and people make money off that. Yep. If not him, or his people in his circle. That's all that I thought was worth reporting on. I mean, and when I reported on it in July, nobody noticed. And for some reason, when I reported on it, in October, everybody focused on it.
Yeah.
Why one and not the other? I have no idea. I don't like to be obviously the focus of stories in my reporting. I'm just trying to be reportorial, and I'm glad that the senators and two congressmen thought it was worthy of having these agencies whose job it is to investigate things to investigate them. And as we started this conversation, I'd be thrilled if there was nothing to this, because that's much better than if there is something to this. But my gut tells me there is something to this.
Well, along those lines, let's talk about this Slate piece by Felix Salmon. Do you think the criticism of your article was fair? I mean, did Felix was pretty harsh. I mean, the headline itself essentially says your entire piece is bullshit. I mean, what was your reaction to that attempted takedown?
Well, I know Felix. I've been on TV with Felix. Felix likes to be a contrarian.
Yeah.
And take the opposite sides of pretty much any argument or any article that anybody else writes or does. Right. So this is par for the course. I completely disagree with it. And it wasn't just Felix. It was Bloomberg also sort of came attacking. And, my view, and one of the Bloomberg columnists came attacking. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't understand why one journalist would attack another journalist for just being reportorial.
Yeah.
It's not like I'm personally asserting these things. I'm just being reportorial, which is what journalists are supposed to do.
That's right.
I don't know why, and they don't know the answer about whether these trades were totally legitimate, like they claim, and that the story was quote unquote bullshit and should be taken down. And why? I don't understand why one journalist would do that to another when you're just being reportorial and just trying to get shine a light on what may be happening or not. As I said, and you said, I'd be thrilled if there was nothing to this, but I fear there might be something to this, which is why I felt it was worth reporting. And it wasn't me. Like, I wasn't making these trades. I wasn't watching these tapes. I was talking to people who were making these trades and watching this timing. And so that my job is to be reportorial, just like it is on the previous 1,000 stories I've written. I can't explain why this one, got the daggers out, other than maybe Felix wants clicks on his piece, so he tries to take down somebody else.
I mean,
I don't understand it.
Even from a basic human level, why anyone would give Donald Trump the benefit of the doubt at this point, given his entire track record?
Yeah, why does Felix Salmon want to be giving Donald Trump the benefit of the doubt on this?
Yeah. Exactly.
I'm who knows?
Yeah. Well, I mean,
Bloomberg, maybe they have, they have a product to protect that is tremendously linked to the proper functioning and confidence people have in the capital markets. Maybe that's why they had to discredit me. And I used to be a Bloomberg columnist, one of the first Bloomberg columnists. I was a reporter for, I wrote a lot of stuff for Bloomberg Business Week and was an on-air person at Bloomberg TV for many years. Mm-hmm. So not sure why they felt the need to come after me. Yeah. Look, whatever, you're in the arena, one story, everybody's asleep on, the other one they wake up for. I can't explain either one.
Mm-hmm.
I thought people should have made more attention in July. I think people overreacted to the story in October, and there you have it.
Yeah, well, I am guilty among those. I wrote 1,000 words for Salon, pegged right off of your most recent one. I noticed something, too, in the process of putting together my own analysis of what was going on. I noticed something that Slate ignored, which was Trump's own history of greenmailing, along with his dad, Fred Trump. I mean, this is detailed in that massive New York Times piece about Trump's various financial scams. I mean, can you describe what greenmailing is and why it's not difficult to make a jump from that to what we're observing with Trump now?
Greenmailing is a practice that I think takes a lot more subtle forms than it used to take, but a corporate raider used to buy a position in a company and then essentially to make them go away cause their sable rattling to stop. Corporations thought it would be better to sort of buy them out of their position at a profit.
Yeah.
So instead of blackmailing, it became greenmailing. I think the same thing happens today, frankly, with activist investors. I don't ascribe any bad motivations to I say Elliott Management and their fight with AT&T. But I mean, there's an example where they took a big position of like $3.2 billion and then rattled the cage at AT&T with a very thoughtful presentation. And now, a month later, we're talking about settlement, the stock goes up, and, they've obviously made a profit. They still own their stock. They haven't sold it back to AT&T at a profit, so it's a little subtler thing. But, there are a number of activist investors, less so these days than maybe in the previous 5 years who, you know, would take positions in companies and then talk their own book on CNBC or Bloomberg. And, you know, while they were talking their own book, the stock would go up. I mean, what a great position to be in if you're Carl Icahn or Bill Ackman or a few others who can get on TV, Dan Loeb, David Einhorn, and talk your book and get your positions to either go up or go down as a result of talking about that. I mean, that's a license to print money. That also should be, frankly, not legal. That should be something that there are regulations and laws against. But,
so that's, but you know, wait a minute. That is, greenmailing is legal. Is that what you're saying?
No, I'm not saying, no, I don't think, I mean, look, I'm not a lawyer. Is greenmailing has been legal. I don't, maybe it has been outlawed at this point in terms of an Asher Adelman, holding up a company in the 1980s. And having the company buy back their stock at a profit to go away.
Yeah.
Again, I don't know whether that's legal. It should be illegal. I don't know whether that is illegal anymore. I'm saying nowadays it's much more subtle, right?
Yeah.
So what happens nowadays is these so-called activist investors who used to be corporate raiders, their name and their nomenclature evolved from being corporate raiders, like Carl Icahn and Asher Adelman, to being quote unquote activist investors like Carl Icahn and Bill Ackman and David Einhorn and Dan Loeb, and Elliott Management. Okay, so what these guys have done, and they're big, they are powerful, they control a lot of money, they also have great access to the media, or they did until in the last year or so, people sort of soured and become a little bored of them. Mm-hmm. But the idea being that they take these positions and then they go on TV and they are able to, you know, go to these Sohn conference or whatever it is, make their pitch, get a lot of media attention. I mean, CNBC would just like open up the pipes for Bill Ackman during his Sohn presentations about Valiant. Or a short position on Herbalife, and basically that moves the market in a favorable direction for their benefit.
Yep.
And, frankly, I don't think that's right. I've written New York Times columns about that, especially like with Bill Ackman and Allergan. You can read about it, as mm-hmm. they say. I don't think that's right. That should not be legal, but nobody's looking into that. I mean, the SEC has completely abdicated their responsibility, the regulatory responsibility and role in the last decade. I mean, it's just appalling.
Yeah. And in fact, I assumed it was illegal because, I mean, I first heard of greenmailing from Wall Street. Gordon Gekko in Wall Street is a greenmailer. In fact, Terrence Stamp refers to Gekko as a two-bit pirate and a greenmailer. I also know Rupert Murdoch.
Based on reality of Carl Icahn and Asher Adelman and these quote-unquote corporate raiders of the 80s.
Yeah, and in fact, Rupert Murdoch also engages in greenmailing. Have we ever had a president, Bill, who embraced his ability to manipulate the markets like this? I mean, have we heard of this before? Is there any kind of precedent whatsoever in terms of this story?
Look, I guess what? No surprise. I mean, he's, I believe Trump is the first president not to divest himself of his businesses, right? So he refused to do that. So therefore, he's still in the business of making as much money as he possibly can. I don't think he counted on the people shunning his brand. I mean, I saw that was obvious, but of course, I don't think he thought that. And we never had a president who, you know, enjoyed manipulating the markets, as George Conway said, more than this guy. He loves it. He loves it.
Yep.
This is his passion. He loves people paying attention to him and his tweets and reacting to his tweets and driving the markets up and down. He loves that, and that is pure market manipulation, pure and simple. Whether he is benefiting personally from that, I have no idea if he is or whether we'll ever be able to find out. My guess is we will never be able. My guess is he is, but we'll never be able to find out, and no one will ever stand up. I mean, I can't imagine a Donald Trump appointee at the SEC or the CFTC ever standing up and saying this is what is actually going on, or at the FBI, you know, as much as he's probably, they probably feel aggrieved at the FBI by all of what Donald Trump has said about them. I don't feel like there's a chance that they're going to step up either. I'm sure it's, I mean, as somebody tweeted the other day, we're never going to know the full extent of all the manipulation that Donald Trump has perpetrated. Maybe, you know, once all the records become public in 50 or 100 years, we might know. But I think this is bigger than, I think it is obviously, I think, a much bigger scandaling than even with Nixon. And I grew up with Nixon, certainly more than Teapot Dome. I mean, more than anything that I can recall either in my lifetime, certainly, and even in any of the history of America that I have read. I mean, this guy has got it all, and apparently he does it all with impunity.
Yeah.
So,
I mean, what we really need is a whistleblower. We need a whistleblower to step forward. I think it seems to me as if the only way to connect some of these dots is to get the direct information in terms of basically follow the money. It's essentially a follow the money
story. If I were on the other side of these trades,
yeah,
and people had actually had information that I didn't have, and they benefited and I lost, I would be going to the SEC or the CFTC and blowing the whistle and letting them know. I'd be ripped.
Yeah.
But.
Yeah. Well, you know, I took a look at Trump's financial disclosures to see if I could find anything in there. I'm not quite savvy enough to understand. Well, first of all, I should say, I pretty much assume the financial disclosures are bullshit, too. I'm just start from that position that he's lying on his financial disclosures.
I've looked at those financial disclosures, yeah, and they are not the whole. That is not the whole picture, not even close.
Yeah.
And even what's there is completely opaque. And I mean, I've dug into it. I mean, there's a lot that he does not disclose.
No.
And get away with that. What doesn't he get away with?
Yeah.
He's gotten away with everything.
He has. It's just a bunch of ETFs and mutual funds. Is that what you saw? There wasn't really anything.
He had some stock positions through Deutsche Bank. I mean, you know, I think, frankly, you know, we're going to have to wait and see. David Enrich, the finance editor at the New York Times, a great reporter and writer, has a book coming out on Trump and Deutsche Bank in February. So maybe that'll be revelatory, and we'll learn more. I wrote a big article in The Atlantic in January of 2000 or the end of 2013, I guess, before Trump was a candidate even thought about being a candidate, about why Wall Street doesn't do business with him and why Wall Street shuns him. And, you know, the only firm that did business with him and still does is Deutsche Bank. And the question is why? And I've always wanted to know why. And I always wished I could follow the money. I always wished I had subpoena power to follow the money. But, you know, without subpoena power, journalists can't do it.
That's right. And, you know, neither of us are activists, Bill, but what would you consider the best way to elevate the visibility of this story, especially given how financial services happens to be one of the House committees tasked with looking into impeachment articles?
Well, I mean, I think the senators have asked for an investigation. Two House people have asked for an investigation. I fear that it'll just go into the black hole of the news cycle, and they've asked for it, but nothing will ever come of it. And I think that's why people are saying we'll never know the full extent of the corruption, the level of corruption that Donald Trump is and his people have been up to. I just feel like we're never going to know, and the best we can hope for is either he steps down before next November, or he gets resoundingly defeated at the ballot box a year from now. And, you know, if he doesn't, then, you know, shame on us, woe to us. And, you know, you can call me a libtard or whatever you want to do to insult me. I don't care. I welcome your insults. But, you know, objectively speaking, you know, he is a disaster for our country, and he's destroyed our reputation around the world. And the incredible thing is he's utterly Orwellian about it, where he down is up, black is white, bad is good, good is bad. He has an uncanny ability to believe his own bullshit and just try to convince the rest of us of it. And, you know, fortunately, 60% of the population is wise to it, and another 40% isn't. But, you know, the American people gave us Donald Trump. He is you know, he's reflective of us at this particular moment. And that's the saddest thing of all, but that's the way it is.
You know, I feel like a bit like Charlton Heston in Soylent Green screaming about this particular story. Is this something that you're going to continue to pursue? I mean, are you still chasing it down? And is Vanity Fair on board? Are you finding that editors are, you know, basically embracing what you have to say about this?
I think there's likely to be more. I think both something that I mean, I've certainly been alerted to other instances. Whether you know, Vanity Fair is going to be interested in publishing more on this remains to be seen. I think, you know, the bar has gotten higher now because there's, you know, just a whole group of new people who are focused on this. I think there's more. I think there's other instances. I don't think this is the only one. But, you know, we're going to have to work that much harder to get even more detail and more instances and have other people come forward to, you know, talk about it. It would be nice if some of the people on the other side of some of these trades who've lost money would come forward and seek me out. They're certainly welcome to do that. No, I think, obviously, after the July piece, nobody anticipated the kind of reaction that we got from the October piece. And, you know, I think on the one hand, media organizations like the attention. On the other hand, they don't like to be in the spotlight. You know, I think, you know, Vanity Fair isn't you know, necessarily thrilled about you know, they don't break news per se. They're more, you know, write narrative, entertaining stories that also have news in them. But you know, I don't think they are a news organization the way, you know, maybe the New York Times is a news organization that, that you know, said, okay, you know, keep following this, keep going. You know, I think they're, you know, interested, but we'll have to see how enthusiastic they are about future stories.
Yeah, and it's hard with the fire hose of news coming from the White House. It's really difficult to get something to resonate, but I hope this really does, because it not only is a crime. It's, I mean, it's something that Donald Trump is doing that is absolutely 1,000% hinky, but it's also affecting businesses. It's affecting the markets. It's affecting other people's money. And as the steward of the economy, as I was saying before, if he's doing this, we're not talking about victimless crimes here. We're talking about there are victims in all of this. And I hope it actually gets fully chased down. I hope we're not waiting decades to find out what happened here.
I sincerely hope you're right.
Right.
But I've lost a lot of confidence in our institutions' ability to, and you know, even before Donald Trump, honestly, I've been outspoken and critical of the way I thought the Southern District of New York handled the investigations into wrongdoing on Wall Street that caused the financial crisis, you know, 11, 12 years ago. And, you know, I think, you know, Preet Bharara, who now we mythologize as this, you know, a martyred former U.S. attorney in the Southern District of New York, he was quite disappointing in his unwillingness to investigate and prosecute wrongdoing on Wall Street leading up to the financial crisis of 2008. So, you know, I think a lot of our institutions have let us down.
Well, some of them have done okay, given the circumstances, but certainly not well enough, that's for sure. I really hope you continue working on this story, and I'm grateful for, despite the fact that few people read the July piece, people finally looked at the October one, because, again, I don't want to seem like a conspiracy theorist. I don't want to feel like I'm the only one wearing a tinfoil hat in all this, but, you know, goddammit, it's obvious. It's so goddamn obvious what's going on here. So thank you for pursuing it. Appreciate it.
Thank you for writing what you wrote, and thank you for having me on, and with a little luck, maybe we'll talk again, because something significant will have come out of all of this.
Oh, yeah. I'm not letting go. So we'll definitely talk again, Bill. Thank you so much for your time today.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Hey, Hey, it's Stephanie Miller, America's original sexy liberal, if you don't count Millard Fillmore. Come join us for the Happy Hour podcast. You're probably already doing plenty of drinking and swearing with this stain of a president in office. Well, join me and my celebrity and comedian friends for a raunchy, uncensored ride through politics and pop culture. Pants optional.